Talking. Hey, everybody. Welcome to Now We're Talking. I'm your host, Jeff Bryant. You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM, and Keith Kennedy's in the studio, as always. And our theme for this week's show is stage fright. This week, I had the chance to talk to Ashley Morrison, who's a colleague of mine. She's a professional singer here in Vancouver, and we're going to get to that in a little bit. But I thought we'd start the show by just discussing our own experiences of stage fright. And of course, this show is a radio show, which is live. It's also a podcast. And for you and I, Keith, we decided we wanted to do a podcast. We thought we should might as well do it on the radio to have that live component, because I felt like, you know, if you do the podcast at home or in your basement, or even if we came and did it here at the studio, I enjoy the stakes of it being live. Even if I'm not convinced, by the way, listeners, that you are a listener and that you're listening, I'm not convinced that we have a lot of, we have a listenership, but just in case we do, it's exhilarating to perform live.
Yeah. Well, it's funny that you say that, because I was just playing a game right there. Because I didn't say anything off the top, I was thinking, how long on live TV can I go without radio without saying anything?
Oh, no, this is going to be broadcast on television.
That too. Without saying anything, before it starts to seem like you were just pretending I'm in the studio.
Yeah, we'll be probably, I don't know, I think people will go with you probably 8 to 10 minutes.
Really?
That's my experience.
Especially if I did like a canned answer, like, yes,
yeah,
after you spoke.
I just have it as a tape that I play. Yeah. But Keith, you're a writer.
Keith is on today.
We've discussed in the past how Keith and I, this is going to become legendary, that Keith and I once did. I hope that this podcast becomes huge, and it becomes legendary that at one point in our lives we did high school theater together.
We did a professional show together.
I love the idea of drawing attention to it like it was a big thing. But the point is, that was the context in which we met, and we performed live. Now, subsequently, you're a writer, and this has actually been a unique instance where you have dusted off, in a way, your performing chops in terms of being live. What is the last time that you experienced stage fright where you performed live, and there were those stakes, because again, when you're writing, you do it in your own time and you present it to the world, and it's not in a public capacity.
Well, yeah, I think some of my experiences with stage fright are led directly into what I do now, which is to not have any feedback and not have to worry about things. But I didn't get stage fright in the typical sense, not the way that Ashley's going to talk about it.
Right.
I never got like the right before I get on stage jitters or throwing up or anything, which I was always afraid I was going to get. I heard a story where it was Donald Sutherland, something who threw up every time everyone on stage. I was like, I don't want to do that.
Yeah.
But I never really had that. I used to get excited, but I would get really, really bad stage fright for auditions.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Which is, it's interesting because when you perform live, there's going to be potentially more at stake.
Yeah.
I guess it depends how you look at it, though. Yeah. So what was the difference? Why were you generally comfortable performing in front of hundreds of people, but not so much for the small group?
Yeah, I think it's doubt again, which is something we talked about once before, right? That feeling that maybe I'm not good enough. An audition's a test. It's an evaluation.
You're under more of a microscope, maybe.
Yeah.
That's true. Actually, that was one thing Ashley and I discussed in the interview was, I'm not sure whether it made it to the tape or not, but we had discussed one of the first times she performed in front of an audience was when she joined this corporate cover band where she worked. And the first gig they did was in front of a thousand people.
Oh, wow.
And we were talking about how usually for people when they dabble in performing as a musician, maybe they do some open mics.
Yeah.
And there's a dozen people there and most of them are waiting to play.
Yeah, it's four people and your mom.
But the thing is, it's funny you say your mom, because she talked about the difference between performing for 1,000 people versus she performed at her mom's birthday party in front of 20 people, and she was like sweating profusely. It was much more anxiety provoking. And we talked about the difference between when it is a giant crowd, somehow there is less pressure. You'd think that you're under more scrutiny, but it's just that the room, the temperature of the room is different. The expectations are different. You're not under the same microscope when it's a small, intimate setting, and people can really pick up on, like, they're close enough to you that they can see your eyes and they can see that you're sweating.
In auditions, too, you're with your peers often. Sometimes they're private auditions, but oftentimes, especially with musicals, it seems like there's people around. And I remember multiple auditions when we were really young where it would be like, that girl that I thought was cute was nearby.
Yeah.
And I mean, I was a classic tanker of auditions.
What would happen when you auditioned? So let's talk about this.
I would be afraid to adjust things. Like whatever happened at the beginning, if they said, Keith, sing this song, and it was not the song I had practiced, I would just sing the song they told me to.
Because you'd anticipated what the experience would be like.
Yeah.
You'd played out the movie in your head,
yeah.
and you were ready to do precisely that.
Mm-hmm.
But if it deviated from the script,
yeah,
you're off book now.
I was too caught up in that fear to make any waves or correct things. I remember doing an audition for a show where I was expected to get like my first lead.
Right.
And the in the audition, which was a token audition for some of like the fund, people are funding it or something.
Mm-hmm.
It was just to show that I was going to be capable. And the guy played the song in a different key for me. And I just sang it in the wrong key. And I didn't get the part.
It was way too high?
It was not way too high, just high enough that in like the crucial moment where
the,
I had to
the
be
big note.
When I had to be at the full voice,
yeah.
it was just out of my range.
Yeah.
And so instead of, it was like,
and the whole, when did you realize, as soon as you started singing, was it clear that it was something
yeah,
was wrong?
Yeah, but that thing happens where you go, okay, well, I guess I can do that.
Yeah.
I'm already in it.
Yeah.
I didn't want to, it just seemed like the worst idea ever to stop.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah,
if
so
if you get to the point where you're comfortable enough, you could probably say, "Oh, I think can we stop. Which key are we in there?" And clarify.
Yeah.
But in a way, you also don't want to open up a can of worms by having some protracted conversation that
exactly.
you might not find your way out.
Or or like now I look difficult.
Yeah,
something.
Yeah. Now you look like you're a prima donna. Or
yeah,
something.
And those are all pretty silly fears for that age. But it was because I was young, I guess, too. And experience. Like, if I had gone through that a couple of times, I think maybe I would have done better. And that's
yeah.
what you're seeing, I think, when people really do well in auditions, you're seeing experience.
It's true. Again, that was something that came out of the conversation I had with Ashley, was we talked about how there's no mystery, really. The more, regardless of whether, well, put it this way, like, the more prepared you are for what's going to happen as a performer, the more you're able actually to roll with those punches
yeah.
too. So it's not so much that you know exactly how it's going to play out and it needs to go that way perfectly to be fine. It's that you've done it enough times with little things happen here or there. You kind of know how to adjust.
Yeah.
And it's we talked about how it's true for anything you aspire to do in life, not just performing, how, you know, it's a good reminder not to be too hard on yourself when you first do something, if it's
mm-hmm.
not what you'd hoped it might be. Because you got to log some time.
Yeah.
And I think that's a hard thing for me. And I think it's probably hard for a lot of people, because if you're inspired to do any given thing, let's say it's singing, the reason you're inspired to do it is probably because you're looking at the people that are the ultimate for you, like your heroes. Like
mm-hmm.
that's what's inspired you to take an interest in singing. And you can see that they're at this incredibly high level and you're at... what you're doing is not at
no.
all like what you're inspired
mm-hmm.
by.
And your fear is that that will be shown in glaring
yeah, you're being,
clarity.
It's being revealed that you're a fraud and
yeah.
that it's ridiculous that you should even attempt this.
Yeah.
And I think it's really hard for anybody to be conscious of that, mindful of that, and then to...
excel.
Yeah, or just to be kind to themselves as they make those mistakes and realize you have to make those mistakes
yeah.
to,
oh, yeah.
to get
at
better.
At that age, when I was 15 or 16, I did not have that capacity.
And the truth is, even if you did understand all these things conceptually, it's one thing to know them, but it's another thing to abide by them when you're in that situation. Well, let's dive in and get to that interview. Again, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to Now We're Talking on CITR 101.9. This is my interview this week with Ashley Morrison.
I started off as most, I imagine, kids, like, grew up singing, really enjoyed music, surrounded by it my whole life. But whenever I sang, I always sang in the privacy of my own room. Like, I never, ever sang in front of people.
Yeah.
And then my dad would overhear me singing, and when I was 8 years old, he made me audition for this, like, choir, and it was some special choir, but at the time I thought it was super nerdy, and I was like, I'm not going to go in the choir. So I actually threw my audition. And I
oh, really?
Really? Yeah.
So you went on the audition to satisfy, you know, your dad's setting it up or
yes.
what have you, but you deliberately failed the audition.
Yes.
How did you do that? How did you throw it?
I just remember, like, singing, like, not singing well, and I just kind of tried to sing off key, which is actually surprisingly hard if you can sing. It's hard to sing off key. but anyway, so I just tried to sing not that well, and then acted like I was really nervous, and almost maybe gave him the impression that I probably wouldn't be good in choir because I couldn't even sing in front of him.
Right.
Like this person that was holding the audition. So ended up getting the letter in the mail that was like, oh, you know, Ashley didn't make the choir. My dad was like, I can't believe this. And I was like, well, I don't know what happened, Dad. You know, just kind of played dumb, 8 years
yeah.
old. Anyways, and then it wasn't until I was 26 years old, like, that I finally auditioned for the Telus band, for a corporate band, and that was the first time I ever really sang in front of people ever, and that was 26.
So what caused you to do that? After all those years, what was the catalyst for you to put yourself in that situation, which... The interesting thing about singing is for a lot of people, it's the ultimate fear. Public speaking is scary enough, but to sing is like the worst. So for you, was there a reason why you put yourself in that situation? Were you confident it would be fine, or were you anxious about it?
No, first of all, that's funny because now I always say I'd rather sing in front of people.
Yeah.
I'd rather sing than speak.
Yeah.
I hate public speaking. I'd way rather sing.
You should just, if you ever have a situation you're doing public speaking, just sing the words that you're saying. Thank you for your kind attention. Just to get through it.
Like a scene from Elf or something. Where I always start singing. But I don't know. I think it was my own big mouth. I think I would tell people that I could sing and that, you know, oh, I can sing, and I can sing like this, and I can sing these songs, and it was eventually kind of a, you know, put your money where your mouth is, and I knew that Telus had a band, and they were looking for female singers, and I honestly don't even remember how it came about, but they were going to be holding auditions, and it was me and I think a couple other people that auditioned, and even on the way to the audition, I was on the phone with my ex at the time, and I was like, you know, trying to talk myself out of it, like, I can't do this, and he was like, you've got to do this, like, you just got to go, like, trust me, just go, it's like, the idea, like, the fear is way worse than it actually will be,
mm-hmm.
And, you know, pulled over, because I was dry heaving, I'm like, I'm going to throw up.
So you're really having intense physical response, not just an internal experience of anxiety, but it was really overt.
Yeah, like it was like I did not want to do this, and everything inside of me was like, don't do this, it's going to be terrible. and then I got there, and they had me sing, you know, the three songs they had picked out. It was like What's Up by the Four Non Blondes, Respect, obviously Aretha Franklin, and then I can't remember the other one.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, Rock and Roll by Led Zeppelin.
Were these already songs that were in your shower time or around the house repertoire?
No.
Okay.
I mean, the Led Zeppelin, I grew up on all classic rock, so I was used to that, but
yeah.
not the other two.
Yeah.
And, so then it was like, got the call back, and they were just like, you know, we really love it if you want to be a part of the band. And then I was like, oh, no.
What have I gotten myself into?
Yeah.
Were you surprised that they had selected you, or did you settle into the audition process and think, actually, that went pretty well?
No, I was still terrified, and I regretted everything, and I was like, I can't believe I did this. And
oh, really?
You know, and yeah, like I was really quite petrified. And then the good news is they only had me, since it was so close to their like Christmas gala where they performed, like they performed at their interval event. It was so close, they only had me come up for one song. So I only sang Rock and Roll by Led Zeppelin, and I don't think my feet moved. Like I think I was so firmly planted on that age and so freaking terrified that I just was like, you just got to get through this song and then you can leave and go home and die.
I'll just die later. I want to die in private. I don't want people to witness my death. I'm mortified at the thought of that.
You know what you're just making me realize is for my husband who is has grown so much within his own career. He started off working the bar, and working a bar, he felt like the bar was like a safety net, like it was kind
mm-hmm.
of like a divider, right?
Yeah.
And so I think that the stage has been that for me, because even though I am, you know, not wanting to be in front of people, I do not want to be a performer. I am not a performer naturally. At the same time, there's like safety on the stage.
Yeah.
And I feel like it is this one arena where like me, Ashley, the, you know, 6-year-old girl who would be singing Joan Jett and Madonna and all this stuff on top of her lungs, like the stage has now become my bedroom just with the walls down.
Yeah.
You know, so it allows me to kind of be me. It's taken some work because like I said, I'm not a natural performer. It's taken more work for that, but, it's allowed me just to be myself. And I think there is a safety on the stage, you know, versus if you're actually one-on-one with somebody.
Yeah.
You know, as soon as I get off the stage, I have a real hard time. Like, I don't want to be approached by people. I don't want to talk to people. Like, I just want to, like, get away and run and hide. You know, like...
It's funny because I feel the same way. socially, it's certainly in the context after performing. And in a way, actually, I do want to have connections with people, but I feel sort of shy and apprehensive about living up to their expectations, perhaps. But it's funny that you say that because, you know, I've witnessed your ability to interact with people, and nobody would ever know that. So I find it so interesting. For myself.
Oh, that's good to hear.
Yeah, well, it's absolutely true. I believe you when you're saying it. But from mm-hmm. my experience of witnessing you, I know that nobody would ever imagine that to be the case. So it makes me think about how what we're feeling on the inside might be different than what we're able to actually manage.
Well, I was just discussing that recently, actually, saying that you are one of the people that I've really grown with on stage, because you have such a natural presence and you're able to interact with people, and you know, I'll often get like the nudge, like, hey, you should talk more to the audience. But for me, it's like I don't, because I'm always afraid they're not going to respond. So yeah. And I just assume, oh, they don't want to hear from me; they just want to hear the music.
Well, why do you think? Like, look at me now. I've isolated myself into a sound isolated booth in a basement. This is now not just how I quote unquote perform, but this is how I interact with people. So I'm glad that something good came of my performing career, so that it can live on through others, you know, while we talk in the base. Well, I appreciate you saying that. That's interesting. It's interesting what we can, you know, you and I have experience performing together, which is why I was looking forward to talking to you.
Yes.
About this, because I've been able to witness your growth and also check in with each other and share that process. And what's, so you moved from the TELUS band
right.
to singing for Side One, which is a band in Vancouver. What
yeah.
has your experience been in the last 4 or so years performing pretty regularly with a, you know, a band that's in high esteem and plays some mm-hmm. really big gigs, and the level of professionalism amongst the other musicians is very high. Has that mm-hmm. been a good opportunity for you to just continue to grow in terms of your comfort on stage?
Absolutely. You know, the TELUS band was definitely like a great start. And then coming into Side One, it was very intimidating at first because it's all genres. Like, as you know, it's everything from pop and rock to country and R&B, soul, whatever. It's like everything. So that was intimidating at first. However, that actually helped me grow as a singer. So that confidence, like, you know, obviously helps and translates on stage. But I think I'm somebody who really loves routine. Like, I probably would have died if I had to do kind of like improv in high school. Like, I never took drama. Like, I'm not into improv. So I really like structure. So I think that's one thing I really love about Side One, is I kind of mm-hmm. know what to expect. I know what the set lists are, you know, like, for the most part, unless we change it up when we have to. But I like knowing what to expect. And I think that helps me on stage, because if I kind of have the foundation, if the foundation is laid and I kind of know what's going to happen,
mm-hmm.
then I'm free to be myself, the best self I can be in that moment, because I kind of know the plan. You know, it's like, okay, the machine is working, now I can go off and, you know, do this other thing and perform. I think Side One has definitely helped with that, because there's just a bit of a security in what it is, which allows spontaneity from a performing aspect.
Yeah, it's interesting. It has so much, obviously, stage fright. It's all about managing fear, and a lot
yeah.
of that is about, you know, you're imagining what's potentially going to happen, whether you're playing it out actively
yeah.
in your mind, or whether it's more unconscious. I've found for myself, in any given performance situation, and there's been different contexts for that, I realize it really comes down to how much certainty do I have of how this is going to play out, the things I know that I'm capable of or I've done before, versus the things I'm unclear about. That maybe sounds obvious, but that's so much of it. There's also the
mm-hmm.
but there's also the element of letting go too, because mistakes can happen on stage, and
mm-hmm.
yeah, I know it's, you know, and for me, it's when I have gotten to a point with a given thing, let's say with a certain repertoire of music as a singer, and I feel very confident walking onto the stage because I know what's going to happen, I then wonder why in other areas of my life I feel so unsure of myself, maybe even like you mentioned before, when you walk off the stage socially. And it's because I don't know what's going to happen. And, you know, but by all means, I have experience in my life of coping well or doing well with uncertainty. But it can be stressful. So I'm not surprised that it's become more comfortable.
It's like the people who become comfortable in prison, you know, because they want to go back in after, like, people who have been in
right.
prison,
yeah, yeah.
You know, it's very common. They're in there for like a decade and then they want to go back in because at least they know the drill.
That's
you know,
true.
And that's now they're home. you know, and yeah, so there's the comfort and like kind of knowing what's going to happen. But with that said, you know, like you mentioned, things don't always go as planned. And it was a really good learning for me, like the first time I forgot lyrics or the first time my voice cracked or the first time, you know, just whatever, like they changed the set list on the fly. Like you realize like life goes on, everything's fine, the world didn't end.
Yeah, nobody pointed and stared and said, why?
Yeah, exactly.
Why?
Exactly. Like, you're fired.
I expected so much more. I'm not even talking about somebody in the band. I'm talking about just a random member of the audience who's like, nobody else is noticing this, but I know what you've done, or more accurately, failed to do.
But at the same time, I think people really love that human aspect. Like, people don't want you to be perfect. And when you have people like, you know, Adele's in Vancouver tonight performing, and that's somebody who sings live, and she's not always perfect, but people really love that about her.
Yeah.
You know, like, it doesn't have to be perfect. You're human, you know, like there's a difference between missing a note or two or being a bit pitchy versus like completely, you know, annihilating a song and bombing. Like there's a big difference.
And the truth is, the worst case scenario, if you make a mistake, let's say, for example, you and I made mistakes in our lives and we ended up in prison. You and I could just form a cover band in prison and find comfort in that.
Oh, totally.
You know?
Be so comfortable.
As long as it's some sort of progressive prison system that allows for you know, different genders to be represented, then you and I could form a cover band. We'd already know a bunch of songs. We'd already know what we're doing. And it would give us something, a good version of Yard Time.
Maybe they'd even let us tour. That'd be amazing.
Tour the prison system?
Yeah.
That would be, or maybe just tour the facility.
I think the key thing is knowing, to get over stage fright, like, if you have, because I've talked to other, you know, session singers and other performers, and almost everyone, I'd say, has rituals, like things that they do to kind of like get themselves, you know, prepared for the stage. And I think that that's really important. And I saw a clip yesterday by Gary Vaynerchuk, and he said, somebody was asking him the question, like, you know, so is it true that the early bird gets the worm, or is it the bird that studies the sleep habits of the worm that gets the worm? And he said it's both. He said it's the bird who had the most self-awareness. And you need to know yourself. So some people, for example, have a lot of talent, you know, whether that be through your musicianship or as a vocalist or as a performer. And in some ways, therefore, you don't need to work as hard, you know, on that craft per se.
Sure.
But then there's some people who don't have a lot of talent. They have a little bit of talent. So for me, I kind of put myself in that category. Like, I can sing, but I'm not a natural performer. So I have to work harder, you know, to kind of like to bring that. So I think it really boils down to knowing yourself and knowing what works for you. And then once you can kind of create that perfect kind of like ecosystem for you to grow, then I think the stage fright kind of dissipates and kind of disappears. Like, you just need to get to know yourself. And then at the end of the day, you just need to suck it up and do it and then realize it's not as bad as you thought it was.
Yeah. But, and just get on with it.
There is some tough love that needs to take place for sure. You just need to be like, you know what? Get the F over it and just do it.
I guess, you know, it's funny because I think you reminded me of one of the reasons why I think I sought to perform in the first place, and why it's been a part of my life, is because as much as anybody, it feels like, and maybe even more so, the idea of being the center of attention, like, it doesn't appeal to me. It's something I can...
No, yeah.
It's something I can potentially enjoy under the right circumstances or tolerate, but it's not something that I'm certainly not something I'm looking for. And therefore, it's, you know, I have lots of experience with feeling terrified about going on stage. But I think the reason it appealed to me earlier in my life was because I figured if I can get through it, if I can survive it, it'll make me feel like other things in life will be survivable as well. And you mentioned that before, going out on stage and being convinced that it's going to be a horrible experience. And even if you do get off stage and you have to retch into a bucket or something, you still, once you retch and now you're off stage and now you're breathing like a normal person, you can notice that it wasn't as bad as you thought it might be.
No, and that's it. Like, after my first audition, when I auditioned for the TELUS band, like, I came home feeling like I could do anything. Like, I was like, I could do anything. Like, I was so proud of myself that I had done this audition, you know? And, I think, that's huge. And that's the irony, too, is that you mentioned being in the booth right now.
Yeah.
Is that even though I had all of this stage fright from the time I was 8 years old on to this day, like, I am not a good, studio performer. Like, I've tried to do top line. I've tried to do all these things, and I just don't enjoy it. I feel like my throat's the size of a pipe cleaner, and I just can't get
so anything
it.
Recorded where there's, like, time is money kind of situation?
Or even just, I think the fact is, and this is, I don't know if irony is the right word for this, but I almost need the audience. That's the weird thing is I enjoy the stage 100 times more because you feed off the energy. When I'm in a sound booth, I'm kind of like, ugh.
Yeah, it can be very clinical, right? I know what you're talking about. If you think that I'm sitting here in this booth by myself, you're nuts. I've got a harem of very silent women all seated, and they're all cross-legged. Hey, girls. And they're all sitting on a bunch of throw pillows that I've set up for them. They understand that it's inappropriate to verbalize. So right now they're being very quiet. But they're all here. They're all here giving me good vibes. And I don't mean to discriminate against men. It just they happen to be women. But
of course.
But if anybody's listening to this and is interested, we could maybe even there's room for like three or four more for the next taping if you're interested.
I'm in, but I also want to bring kittens.
That's a good
we'll
idea.
We'll bring them to prison.
That's really what this interview has been for, is pulling, in, I'm not going to say creating out of thin air, but pulling into focus what the goal is for us in terms of sharing our lives together in the future. In prison, there's a cover band, we do some recording, there's kittens involved, and wackiness ensues. Ashley, thank you for your time.
Aw, thank you, Jeff.
Talk to you soon.
Talk to you soon.
So that was my interview this week with Ashley Morrison about stage fright. You're listening to Now We're Talking this week with your host, Jeff Bryant, and Keith Kennedy is here as always. Ashley, thank you for your time to have that conversation. I thought that was an interesting conversation. You know, I'm sort of deciding what these conversations, how to approach them. And one thing I tried this week was having a specific theme going into the conversation. I thought that was really helpful because there's any number of things Ashley and I could talk about with her experience as a musician or other aspects of her life. But I found it really helpful to specifically talk about that. And it was cool to hear her experience. And I'm definitely enthusiastic. I don't know that I'll wind up in prison, but I don't assume that I won't.
Yeah, why would you? Yeah.
Why wouldn't I?
Yeah, let's prepare for the worst.
It's possible. So there was a part of me that actually took some comfort in the idea that maybe if I did end up in prison, it wouldn't have to be so bad. But let's talk a little bit more about this topic of stage fright, Keith. And I was thinking about this time you told me about you attending your mother's wedding. And we've talked about stand-up comedy before. I attempted stand-up for a period of time, and we had talked about it at the time. And anyway, I think for a lot of people, when it comes to... Now, there's something different here, too, right? There's performing music is one thing. At least you have the comfort of hopefully the band or the song itself. It's prepared.
Yeah.
And comedy is prepared also, but people aren't sitting there... Your introduction isn't, here's so-and-so, he's hilarious, you're going to love him. And they're like, oh, really, is he?
Yeah.
It's something even potentially more challenging and more petrifying for people if it's just speaking.
Yeah.
And you don't have, a device like singing. So what was this experience that you had at your mom's wedding?
Yeah, my mom had kind of a casual reception. It was in a typical reception kind of place, like a big hall with a dance floor and... I think about 75 people there, but there weren't many speeches prepared. So there was, I think, a best man speech. And then the MC, who, this is a strange choice. I don't know. I think he might have just been the DJ. Like, we didn't have...
That happens sometimes at weddings.
Yeah.
So he wasn't even personally acquainted?
No. And so he sort of said something like...
Oh, really?
Like, he's just a guy.
This apparently, by the way, just to interject, is a thing that happens in the States more than in Canada. And I know this because I was performing at a wedding last year.
Oh, I remember that.
In Washington State. with a cover band, with Side One, actually. And at the last minute, the band leader's like, hey, do you want to MC the wedding?
Yeah.
I never heard of that before.
I know, I was so excited. I remember when you told me that I was about to go to a wedding at my friend Tron's in Prince George, and I was like, oh, I hope he gets me to MC.
Yeah, because you kind of, why not have the MC be somebody that knows them very well?
Yeah.
Like the best man or
who's
the maid of honor.
With
and
the
that's,
mic, yeah.
I don't know, I was like, maybe that's a Canadian thing. Okay, so at this wedding, which was in Canada,
yeah,
nonetheless.
It was just a guy.
It was just a guy.
Yeah. Or apologies to my mother and her husband if it was someone.
Maybe it was somebody.
I just didn't know them.
You just think that it's the DJ.
It was like Uncle Steve or whatever.
And he was also asked to be
yeah,
the DJ.
Yeah, he's just a great DJ, Uncle Steve.
Yeah.
Anyway, he said something like, so does anyone want to make a speech? Like left it open to the floor? And I realized that no one had said anything really from my mom's side. And we were in the minority at the wedding because we've all come from the East Coast.
You don't want to leave her hanging.
And I didn't want to leave her hanging. And so it kind of felt, I don't know if everyone looked to me physically or if it was in my head.
Sure.
But I felt like...
Was there a moment where he asked the question and it kind of was hanging? Nobody was answering?
Yeah, he even said something along the lines of, like, any stories or anything? Like, he went to the second level of trying to prompt people to say a word.
Cajoling people.
Yeah, and I thought, oh, this is me. This I realized in about 10 seconds.
If this isn't me, this moment might pass by,
no one.
And nobody's going to step up.
Of course it's me. I'm the eldest son.
Right.
And I'm the one who has some experience.
And to be
performing.
Clear, this hadn't been discussed. Like oftentimes, usually the speeches that happen at weddings
really
are prepared.
Yeah, really prepared.
You know, people have given them some thought. So you hadn't been made aware of this, or you hadn't considered it. And in this moment, impulsively, you said, "Okay, I'll do it."
Yeah, I just stood up to the adulation.
And how are you feeling?
Everyone around me.
Were you feeling any nerves at that juncture?
Well, my mother, as soon as I stood up, my mother said, oh no, in a very like,
here we go.
Like almost a welcoming way. Like, here comes the funny member of my family.
Yeah.
Going to embarrass
that's
me.
Right, that's right.
And
kind of in a way that almost suggests, check out Keith.
Yeah.
He's hilarious.
He's going to kill it. And then I remember, so I was walking. It took me, I don't know, 17 steps exactly to get to the podium. And I thought, oh, no, I don't know any embarrassing stories about my mother. And then I thought, oh, well, that's okay. I'll just, like, do a bit. And so I got to the podium, and I just invented a bit in the whatever 6 seconds it took me to get to the podium.
And a microphone was handed to you.
Yep.
And there's, what, like 100 people there or something. And when you grab the mic and you just said, hey, everybody, like, initially, did you feel like I got this?
Yeah, oh, yeah. The bit I came up with in 6 seconds was the greatest bit you were ever going to hear at a wedding.
In your mind, you're like, this will be great.
Oh, yeah. I was ready to drop the mic and be carried out on everyone's shoulders.
And so how did it play out? What did you initially say?
You know how it played out.
Tell me.
So the bit I came up with on the way to the podium was that it's terrible in hindsight, of course, but I didn't know my mother's husband all that well yet. And so I thought, oh, you know what's a funny bit is if we don't know each other, but I'm going to get...
You and the father-in-law.
Yeah, I'm going to get ridiculed now so badly because it sounds horrible. I thought, wouldn't it be funny if I referenced that we had gone on adventures recently to get to know each other better,
mm-hmm.
but the adventures would be presented as movie plots?
Okay.
So I went up there and I said, I don't know Robin all that well, which right away, of course, is not really a great way to go at the wedding.
Probably people are like, oh, okay, I've heard Keith is very funny. This could be hilarious, a little bit.
And so I started telling the plot of Big.
Assuming that people would catch on?
Yeah, like me and Robin. Like we're the main characters.
We're at a toy store and we start playing the novelty-sized
keyboard.
Yeah,
and then we were at a carnival and we saw this thing. We put the money in and sure enough, we got Big.
So in your mind, you're like, punchline, this is where they'll laugh.
Yeah,
and what, is this dead silence?
Dude, like the crickets were dead. Like it was like nothing.
Why? Because they just didn't follow what you're saying at all?
I would love to pretend that it's because they were just a bunch of humorless dodos, but it might have been me. I don't know.
Do you feel like you were justifying the idea well, expressing it well?
At the time,
or were
I did.
You nervous?
After the first movie, I thought, oh, this can't be me. But in hindsight, I think I like rushed it a little bit, and I didn't pick the right plot points.
Sure.
I wasn't prepared. And
you say the first movie because you had a list of movies you were going
to
go
Well, I started to do another one.
What was the next one?
The next one, I don't remember. I'm sorry for the sake of the story. I wish I did. The reason I don't remember what the next one was because things started to go dark on me. Like, I realized from the moment I started the second one to like 10 seconds later that this wasn't working.
The walls
and wasn't
closing
going
in.
To work. And
I think
so,
this is, by the way, this is part of what happens with anxiety on stage.
Yeah.
Is that when you're not getting the outcome that you'd hoped for, expected, or felt that you needed, you become like instantly flooded with self-consciousness.
Yeah.
Because you're thinking, I've lost perspective on what this is like for other people, and you become so obsessed with that self-consciousness that anything else that you'd otherwise be thinking about, what you're about to say, how you're going to say
it,
goes out the window. And then did it kind of affect how you spoke? Did you start to speak?
Well,
that's
funny,
the nerves
why I can't remember what the movie was, because it was, I lost everything. So I don't recall specifically speaking worse, but I'm sure that I started to hesitate. All of those things, I started to sweat. And I remember turning it into, this was the decision I made. I thought, well, this isn't working. And then I made it like personal to my wife. Like I tried to salvage it for just one person in the room.
Okay.
And I made a reference to a movie that we really like. Which is like pretty much the worst idea. If you want to
salvage. The audience might not get me, but my wife does.
Yeah, pretty much. I was like, instead of salvaging this bit for everyone, I'll just get one person. And so then I bailed. I did two, and I took a deep breath, and I just said something really like genuine and heartfelt to my mother about love, and I'm glad they found each other and all that stuff.
And did the audience go, oh, he's not so bad?
No, they didn't. And then on top of them still being silent, on top of all of that, the best man who had done a speech before and hadn't maybe done all that well either, he came and gave me like a conciliatory hug. And so I
you're walking back to the table.
So it was like the person who also wasn't good at this was telling me it was okay. So even if I was wrong and people had been enjoying it, this was a signal that I was on the team of people who just couldn't do this very well.
What was the applause like when they're like, okay, give it up one more time for Keith?
Minimal. Yeah.
And do you think it was just a matter of them, oh, I don't quite understand the joke that he appears to be making? Or was there the element of them actually being hostile? Like, what is he trying to do?
Yeah, I don't know. I just remember when I got back to the table, my uncle sort of leaned over and said, people who know you understood what you were doing.
But they didn't necessarily find it funny.
Yeah, so I was like, most
even
of the,
those that did.
Yeah, most of the people here have no idea what just happened.
Because it sounds like even the people were the people that do know you, your family, were they at least laughing at your,
there wasn't
your big reference?
Very many of them.
So they were nodding, vague understanding, but it doesn't mean that they were actually saving you.
They never said anything, but I'm pretty sure, having seen me be funny and perform well-ish, I think they were, they knew that I was bombing.
Yeah.
I think they could tell.
Wow. That's that's interesting, man. Do you think that has impacted your desire to be in those situations again in the future? Like, what would it be like if you went to another wedding and were asked, this time asked to speak? Would you take that opportunity to, okay, I'm going to write something, I'm going to do it better this time?
This is interesting.
Or do you have an aversion to it?
That's an interesting question. I think that's the difference between an artist and someone who isn't. That's, artist is a strange word, as we talked about before, and I don't know, I don't mean to be pretentious with that word, but that's the difference, is to me, that's, I don't feel an aversion. I felt like that's what it's like to fail. Next time you'll do these things differently. Yeah, I didn't. Yeah.
How many years ago was that?
I don't know.
What about this? Because
it
was several years ago. Yeah, that's what I figured. And you went to a friend's wedding last summer up in Prince George. So was that what?
Oh, that's funny.
What happened?
I never thought about that. I actually spoke there.
You did?
Yeah.
But this time you were asked to in advance.
It was kind of a similar situation where people could say things that they wanted to, and I just wanted to talk on behalf of my friend. And so instead of trying to be funny, I just tried to be heartfelt from the start. Maybe something I learned from that experience.
And did you actually find some humor
because
you removed that pressure?
Yeah, I think I did really well.
So it sounds like you kind of just remembered, oh, yeah, you went to this wedding
maybe
last
year. Try to make up a bit on the spot.
Well, but is it the case because you didn't, I kind of asked you about that and you didn't consider that.
No.
It sounds, that gives me the impression that there wasn't a lot of pressure. Okay, I got to redeem myself. It seems like you weren't even thinking in those terms.
I think it's just because I'm a verbose guy anyway, and I'm often telling stories and so. So that one was on a stage where I failed, but...
Good. I'm glad that you had that redemption, because part of me
I never thought of it that way. I never thought of it that way.
No, it was. It was redemption.
Cool.
folks, if you're just tuning in, this is Now We're Talking. You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM. I'm your host, Jeff Bryant. Keith Kennedy's in the studio, as always. This week, we've been talking about stage fright. We had Ashley Morrison. She's a Vancouver-based singer on the show. You can check out, when the show's over, you can check out this week's episode of the show and other week's episodes as well by going to CITR.ca or... You can go to iTunes. Did we mention this last week? I can't remember the chronology of this. It might have happened since the last episode.
I don't know.
The show is now on iTunes.
Yeah, we got the.
So I know I know for me, you know, if I'm going to listen to something, I prefer to do it on, do it on the podcast app on my phone, so I can, you know, I actually enjoy listening to podcasts sometimes at
me too.
Double time or time and a half.
Oh, yeah.
And you don't, though. You're saying,
I listen to books at slightly faster.
Okay, for books you do it, but it's different for podcasts somehow. But for me, it's like, depending on who I'm listening to, what the rhythm of it is, I think it just gives me an overwhelming sense of productivity to listen to something that otherwise would take. When you have that, you know, you could watch a movie and fast forward, but you don't actually get the audio.
Yeah.
I think actually if there was a way to do that.
To watch movies faster.
Yeah, on Netflix for TV or films to like do it like 50% faster.
Right.
I think I would actually really enjoy that similarly.
It's funny that you say that because I've done that with a few classics. I'm putting my fingers in the air to
your
quote.
Your fingers and you just
boom,
did
quote.
The air quote thing.
Yeah. Yeah, for some classics, there's a great Tarkovsky is his name, I think, filmmaker, whatever.
Tarkovsky?
Is that right?
We'll look it up on the break. There's not going
to
be
I love how I'm supposed to be like a film guy, and I can remember that guy's name. Whatever.
Right now, there's a guy who loves Tarkovsky, who's just like,
so mad at me.
Brian Hendricks would have been one of those people. You know what, Keith? I'm looking at the time, and I'm realizing we got to talk about what happened this week in the news.
Jeff and Keith present this week's news. Now, a topical...
All right, Keith, so this is a news segment where we talk about what happened this week in the news.
It's a news segment
it's
and a
new
segment.
New news segment. Yeah. What do you want to talk about? What happened this week? I don't know what happened. Tell me.
I know this morning when I got up, everything in my feed was about the Comic-Con that's happening.
Was that this week?
That's big news now.
In San Diego, right?
Geez, remember, like, when we were younger, that wasn't big news? Things have changed so much.
My sense of it, and you can correct me where I'm wrong, my sense of Comic-Con is it's probably been around for, like, 10 or 20 years. And for the last 5 or 10 years, it's entered the mainstream.
Yeah, that's probably about right.
True.
I think it's probably a bit.
And I also feel like there's a lot. I mean, now I feel like there's a lot of different cons, not conferences.
Of course.
There's always been conferences in the world,
but now
at least for a long time.
Always trying to steal
but
your
now
money.
I feel like, are there a lot of different cons that have co-opted that sort of Comic-Con con?
A very
brand?
Meta joke is that there are two cons, as in Wrath of Khan, because of the remake of the
Con. Is there a
Con
Con?
There's two.
Is there a conference
there
about the Wrath of Khan?
There should be a Con Con. Yeah. I bet there is.
There must be.
I bet there is.
I hate the fact that we just had that brief little conversation live on the radio because there's a possibility while we're still finishing up this episode of the show, somebody else is
just going to steal that
purchasing
idea.
ConCon.com.
ConCon.com.
ConCon.com. And now the fact that we talked about this on the air has deprived us of the opportunity.
Well,
anyway,
Keith,
what happened? Please tell me what happened at Comic-Con. I'm getting.
It's just a bunch of crazy stuff. It got so big. I mean, it would almost take the whole episode to talk about all the different things. But they release trailers. That's the big thing that happens for me, at least, at Comic-Con, is they give you a little bit of early peeks at some of the movies you might be excited about.
So they release them at the conference, and then they go online for everybody
else?
Yeah,
and so there's a lot of that yesterday.
So what are the big films that are coming out that they're
promoting? Wonder Woman's a big one, especially for me.
Is it really like Marvel-Con at this point?
Well, no, not right now. It was for a while.
Okay.
But now because of the Superman... movie being made a few years ago on Superman Batman. Now they're going to make a Justice League movie, which is a bunch of superheroes, similar to the Avengers that we all know about.
Yeah.
And now they're finally making Wonder Woman, which is a big deal because they just haven't put a female lead in one
is
of these
movies.
Is
that the actress from The Room?
No, that's something else.
It's a different thing.
Yeah, she's just been cast as the first Marvel solo lead female character movie.
Oh, okay.
A character named Captain Marvel.
Oh, man.
But DC's doing it first. It's Wonder Woman, and it's a big deal for someone like me because I'm a huge fan, and I've been waiting for a character that, and when I grew up, there was no male-female issue with this. There was no, like, a male star would make more money. Reading comic books, I loved the character of Wonder Woman. She deserves her own movie. I'm glad that they're going to do it.
Good. People like you. That sounds so accusatory. People like you, which is to say people that love comic book culture,
this is
a golden era, right?
Totally.
I mean, I'm sure there's been different generations of these movies being made, but it seems to me like this is this is out of control.
This is the heart of it. I just had that feeling this morning.
Growing up, when you were, you couldn't have imagined this culture. It just with Marvel alone, but you're telling me DC is now kind of finding their legs as well, and I'm sure maybe there's others. I can't even keep track, but for me, it's like I remember when Iron Man came out. That seemed like a key moment.
Yeah,
of course,
there's
been some other movies in the years preceding Spider-Man, and there's other movies that were huge too.
Yeah,
but that seemed like a definitive moment where it just became. I don't know. It's like a cool factor or something.
Well, I think it's
movie?
Because Spider-Man and people like Spider-Man and Superman, without getting too nerdy for everybody out there, they're mainstream. They're in the mainstream. You may have heard of Iron Man, but people don't know the story
That's
of
what
Iron
it
Man.
Is.
So then having a huge big budget blockbuster
for DC, right?
Yeah.
Spider-Man is Marvel.
Yeah.
Yeah. Those are two ones like
everybody knows.
You know, but everybody wore the pajamas.
Yeah. Until Iron Man, everyone went, "Oh, I really like this character too. This is a character I didn't know before I walked into this theater,
right.
And now I love him. That's right. When they went, oh, this is a money-making machine.
Right.
Yeah. So that was a big deal. And so, I was going to say, I had that moment this morning with my wife. We were sitting there watching the trailers together, and I was crying, because I cry at trailers, because I love these characters. And we're both sitting there crying and laughing, and we're like, this is for us. Like, pick anything you loved when you were 15, and think about this much being done for that. Like, if you loved, cockroaches when you were a kid, and now it's like... That wasn't a setup joke. We didn't set that up.
We didn't.
But you know what I mean? Like, think anything that you loved when you were a kid, and now, like, a huge section of the entertainment industry is putting a lot of money into that for your entertainment. That's crazy. That just doesn't happen. So that's why it's taking over the bloody world, because there's all these sort of closet fans of this stuff. And then now other people who weren't fans of comics are realizing, hey, this is good stuff. These are stories and characters that have been written for 40, 50, 60 years.
Mm-hmm.
There's
it's
a lot of
forever,
rich
right?
material.
Is part of that the technology kind of caught up with it? Is that an element of this?
I think it probably is.
Obviously, there were superhero movies made in the past.
Yeah.
And, you know, a lot of these franchises go way, way back. Batman, was it in the 60s, the TV show? You think about the aesthetic of that. It seems silly now, but is CGI and the sort of the revolution of CGI, did that play a role in sort of having these worlds become more visceral?
Yeah, I think it was the gatekeeper. It was we don't need that. It's just like any great stories. It's about character.
Yeah.
But we needed to get to a certain level so it looked believable. So then the creators could treat it. Like it was real. The way things work, we look back at something like Lord of the Rings when those movies came out. People said you could never do it. But the way they did it successfully was to treat it all with respect. They presented it as if it was real. There was no in-jokes. It was just, this is a real thing. It's a real world with real characters. And so you need the CG to convince people that you can see it. But once you get over that hump, it's just like any other story. It's about relationships. It's about how the plot moves forward. And like I said, they have tons of material to draw on for these movies. And very talented people. All of the most talented people in the film industry are working on these movies.
So Comic-Con happens every summer, every July,
every year.
Is this something you would ever go to? Would it matter to you to be there?
I almost feel like I have to. I'm not a big fan of the idea of how big it's gotten and just like how ridiculously populated it is, which is funny because that's a bit of a fear thing on theme of what we're talking
about. There you go. Way to tie it in.
Agoraphobia, right? And I don't really want to be there with a million people, and yet being a fan of this stuff since I was younger, I feel like I have to at least go and see it once live.
Interesting. Yeah. Okay, anything else happen in the news this week, or is that the main thing?
Well,
obviously many more things happen in the news, but is that the thing we want to cover or anything else?
Well, I think probably is, just because a lot of the other news, I've noticed this, we talked about this, you and I, off air recently, that a lot of the things in my news feed are so negative. I don't know if it's me or the world, but everybody...
It's interesting, I know this is typical for a lot of people, of course, but it's interesting to hear when we're talking about the news, it's almost become a given that the way you consume what's happening in the news is in that feed.
Yeah.
Now for me, like I refrain from using Facebook as much as possible, but so I don't go through the feed on Facebook. Maybe incidentally, I'm hearing about things using the internet, but it's interesting for me to hear you say that, because it makes me realize in my mind, I'm thinking, what did you see on TV this week or in the paper or on the radio? But it sounds like it's a given. That's the way you get your news is not even going specifically to a news website, but just from social networking. What's interesting about that is that's largely dictated by the friends you keep, is it not? Or how does it work?
I'm not sure. I mean, as we talked about before.
It's interesting how your perspective of the world's news will be which people you've probably friended, isn't it?
I'm not sure if that's how the algorithm works, but my routine is that I turn it on every morning to get through my work. And so it's just the first news thing that hits me. Hmm. I think it might be... like what I like, what I click on, what kind of content. Maybe it has to do with my friends as well.
It's an interesting thing to think. I mean, this is not a new conversation. I'm sure many people have discussed this already with more intelligence, but I'm just reflecting on this idea right now, what it's like with broadcasting to sit down and just, here's the news as we see fit, with whatever channel that you watch, cable news or Canadian news or local news, versus having an algorithm
that tells you
influencing
that
a certain perspective on what's happening in the world. Based on the friends that you have, what you click on, what you like. Of course, the major news stories that are happening are still going to make their way through.
Yeah. Well, what I
guess
like,
I'm just confused whether it's a great thing or not a good thing.
Well, I think it's a good thing for one reason, which is there was a time when news was people who wanted to tell you the truth.
Mm-hmm.
And those people still exist. And I love them. They're great. Real journalists, whatever the word real means, but genuine, heartfelt journalists, we can't get enough of them. But big companies owning media, you're just getting their algorithm.
Mm-hmm.
And so
mm-hmm.
at least when I go onto Facebook and see that, or wherever I go, social media or Twitter, online, it's something that is sort of relevant to me, not to their pocketbook.
Hmm. Well
That's
said.
Why I think it's better. Yeah.
Well said.
Thanks.
Well, we'll talk more about what happened in the news next week.
When Ooh, there's a we're going to do it again?
There's a new news cycle every week, right?
Oh, I didn't know about that.
No, there is. There is. So this will be what we talked about this week. But now it's time for something different here.
It's time for Ask Keith Anything. That's right, folks. You can fax it in. You can mail it in. You can give us a call. You could even send over a mule. As long as there's a question for Keith to answer, that's pretty much the deal. Go ahead and ask Keith anything and he'll answer it to the best of his ability. It could be hilarious, it could be forlorn. Too soon to say, but here we go. This week's edition of Ask Keith Anything.
Okay, so for this week's edition of Ask Keith Anything, Keith, we have some fan mail here.
Ooh.
I say fan mail, it's an email.
Yeah.
It would be
no,
cool.
There's a big bag in the
By
corner.
The way, it's if you want to send us physical mail, that's allowed. And how cool would that be? I mean, I haven't received personal correspondence in the mail for years, but to actually receive it in a professional context would be great. So you can actually send us physical mail to CITR. Go to CITR.ca. You can find the mailing address and send it attention. Now we're talking, and you can send us actual fan mail. Now, this is fake fan mail in the sense that it's not actual mail, it's email. The question this week is from Phil in Kelowna, and he says, Keith, I heard you used to sleep with the lights on. What's that about? What is that about?
Yeah. Well, we picked that one because it's relevant to our theme this week. And there was a time when I used to... I watch a lot of horror movies. I always have. And there was a time when I was doing some research for something I was writing, and it was about serial killers and... just a lot of dark things. And then I watched a TV show, which was about something that they called The Entity. And it was about sleep paralysis, which, if you guys don't know, is a thing, it's a sleep condition where you don't wake up completely, but you think you're awake. Have you heard of this at all?
I'm not sure.
It's the way I've had it described to me is it's sort of like an esophagus where, you know, like your esophagus opens to let air in, but it closes for food.
Mm-hmm.
So some people, when they go to sleep, their esophagus in their brain doesn't close all the way.
Okay.
And so this is where a lot of these myths come from legend, like succubus and incubus and all those old paintings of a gargoyle sitting on a woman's chest and things like that. It's because when you wake up and then you can't move, you start having these fears. So you go, oh, I'm awake, but why can't I move? And then you think, oh, I can't breathe. I'm starting to panic. And then you can hallucinate. So you can dream while you're awake, and you dream some of these archetypical things like old women or shadowy figures.
Hmm.
And this is also, some people believe, where alien abduction comes from.
Okay.
This idea that you're being pinned down and you can't move and there's things in your room.
Hmm.
It's because of this sleep paralysis condition, which is a parasomnia, as it's called.
Okay.
So there was a time when I watched a TV show about this. I learned all of this on the heels of watching a bunch of scary movies for my whole life. And then I watched The Ring. Do you remember The Ring?
I remember. I don't know if I watched it or not, because I'm not really a fan of the genre.
Remember that phenomenon?
I'm aware of it.
Yeah, everyone was talking about it for a while, right?
Yeah.
And it scared the hell out of me. Like, really
isn't
badly.
Isn't there a plot element where there's a TV is involved or something?
Oh, totally.
And you're sitting there watching a TV.
Yeah.
So and did that make it more
Yeah, that's
terrifying?
One of the things that the Japanese horror movies did really well around the time they got really popular. And what they do is they make mundane objects terrifying. So, like, the phone ringing was a scary thing in that movie. The TV having static on it was a scary thing. So all of a sudden you're in your house and you can't get away from terror.
Right.
So I got in this strange mindset and I was starting to have trouble sleeping. And then one night, we don't want to tell too long a story, but my wife and I have a history of silly hijinks in bed because we both have sleep problems.
Mm-hmm.
But one night, I was lying in bed and I tried for hours to get to sleep. And I'd have to play tricks with myself. I'd be remembering all these scary things. And I had a trick where I'd picture Spider-Man, which is relevant to what we were talking about, and the wrestler Bret Hart. That was my trick. I'd picture them in the room guarding me.
Just comforting.
Yeah. And this is a grown man, by the way. This wasn't when I was a kid. This is me and my wife. Like, I'm almost, you know, mid-20s, almost 30. I think almost 30 then.
And guarding you from what specifically?
Just an, it was something to conjure instead of the horrors that I was conjuring.
Yeah.
It was so ridiculous. And then one night I'm about to go to sleep. I've got my I'm tucked up like Cindy Lou Who right under my covers. And my wife sits up in bed, not awake, but she just sits up and turns to me sort of like RoboCop, like her torso turns, and she raises her hand and slaps me on the thigh. And it was because she was thought there was a bug. Mm-hmm. She was sleeping and dreaming about a bug. And I screeched. Like the most terrible.
Were you awake or this woke you up?
This woke me up beyond awake. I was like on another level
of
awake.
So even, just to be clear, even when you're asleep, you're still, was your response, the extremity of your response dictated by a state of anxiety even when you're sleeping?
I don't know. I think it was just because it took so long and I was always having trouble and it was dark and I was afraid of all these things. And
yeah.
So I was just in that moment of passivity before you go, and she whacked me. And I've never screamed like that. I didn't sound like a man at all.
Mm-hmm.
And I sounded like a small girl.
Maybe not even like a human.
Maybe not. But it was like very distinct. It was like, like a couple of those really badly. I think my wife says there was three. I only remember two. But it was, and of course she was, it scared the hell out of her too, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because she would just got woken up by me screaming, holding the covers under my chin and looking, of course, like someone who's about to die. And so I turned the lights on.
This was the catalyst for the lights to go on.
Yeah, I couldn't
it
sleep.
It had never been an issue in your life.
No, and I watched Horror Movies a long time.
So in that moment, was that like you literally got up and turned on the lights and they never went
I had
on?
To turn the lights on or I couldn't sleep. And I think the original was just I turned the lights on and I stayed up.
So what's interesting to me about this is one would think if their experience of fear going to sleep was induced by a lot of these horror films, that it might put a moratorium on the viewing of horror films. But it didn't, did it?
No, it didn't.
So you continued to watch horror films late into the night and then go to bed with the lights on.
Yeah.
Interesting.
The one thing I changed about my life was that I went to bed with my lights on. I would not. I love horror movies so much I couldn't
let it go. You didn't feel like it was the source of the anxiety, or you thought maybe it's the source of the anxiety, but I love it, so I'll live with it.
Yeah, I thought I'd get over it. I'm a grown man.
How long did it take?
A couple of years. Mm-hmm.
And how did the lights, how did you turn the lights
on? I manned up, whatever the hell that means.
Wow. Well, tell me what it means. What happened?
I just got to that point where I thought some of that stuff that had been building up in me had waned. I'd watched a lot of horror movies since that weren't as scary because those particular Japanese ones really messed with me. And then I kind of got used to those. And I think that was it. It was a new thing. Culturally, Asia looks at ghosts and things differently than we do. So it's not just scary, it's strange.
Mm.
Hard to make context. And I just got used to that and realized it was time to go back to growing up. And then I think of, like, I'm going to have kids one day and, like, I can't turn the light off in my room. Like, I had to get over it. So, yeah.
So short answer?
The short answer is...
what was the question again?
Yeah, there was a time when I had to turn the lights on. I admit it. There was a time when I had to... I had to sleep, man. It had to happen.
It was a real thing. Well, folks, if you're just tuning in, and even if you're not just tuning in, the fact remains, this is Now We're Talking. I'm your host, Jeff Bryant. It's CITR 101.9 FM that you're listening to in studio with Keith Kennedy. We've just got a minute or two left in the show, and we want to take a moment here to do what we always do at this juncture, which is to say, what did we learn? What happened? What did we learn in this show?
Just based on what we talked about, I think we
talked about stage fright for the first half of the show.
And
so we learned a fair bit about that by talking to Ashley. We had a conversation about it.
Yeah, I think that fear is normal, man, right? Like,
fear's
it's
normal.
One of those things that you can't necessarily conquer.
It feels like one of the things that we talked about earlier, and I talked about my conversation with Ashley, is, you know, understanding it, conceptualizing it isn't going to make it go away.
Yeah,
but it might help you to manage it.
Yeah, accept it.
Which isn't going to allow you to alleviate its symptoms entirely, but maybe just manage it better.
Yeah, because we all know, you and I have talked about this too, that fear is something you have to face. Oftentimes when you fear it, it's because you need to face it. That doesn't mean conquer it. It doesn't mean be combative about it. But don't let it stop you from doing things. Get up on that stage, and you will, through experience, learn how to handle it better.
All right. That's a good thing that we learned this week.
Yeah, that is a good thing.
What else did we learn?
Comic-Con's happening. If you guys are big fans of that,
yeah.
Check it out. Lots of trailers yesterday. Lots of really exciting ones.
And those are available to you?
Yeah.
What else?
And then
we learned about this very specific experience you had where, as a lover of horror films, it kind of prompted you, ultimately, to have a fear of sleeping in the dark.
Yeah.
The lights went on for a couple years.
Yeah.
But even though the lights were on, it didn't preclude you from watching those horror films.
Yeah.
So I guess what we learned is that you basically love horror films, right?
Yeah, and maybe you just don't let fear beat you in that regard either.
Don't let it do it. Well, that's been this week's edition of Now We're Talking. I'm Jeff Bryant along with Keith Kennedy, and we'll see you next week.